very much for giving us a spatial dimension of the fabric of the city, and Richard Sennett from the London School of Economics. And MIT will now effectively start the series of responses.
Thank you. Once again, I'd like to, on behalf of the London School of Economics, thank you all for hosting us here in Shanghai. I've been asked to do something which I feel a certain unease about, which is to comment on Shanghai as a Westerner who has spent a grand total of 5 days here. Nonetheless, I'm, with your permission, going to offer you a series of reflections from the perspective of someone who really does not know your city at all, about, the, in particular, the issue of the public realm in Shanghai. As I say, my expertise of 5 days has led me to ask a kind of question about your public realm, which is whether it looks forward or backward. And I would like to try to answer that question by talking a little more theoretically than we have so far in this meeting about what a public realm is. As I mentioned to you in my opening remark yesterday, among Western urbanists, the 20th century was a time of great crisis. We seemed to have lost the art of making cities. And no more was this the case than in the making of public spaces that served as spaces of social inclusion. I would just draw to your attention three elements of this crisis that are visually evident. This failure of making public space, cities like London, New York, Paris, in the 20th century. The first of these was that in the 20th century, planning began to make monofunctional ground planes. That is to say, space on the ground, which was designed to serve one purpose only. It begins in an idealistic way, for instance, in the Plan Voisin of Corbusier, in which the ground plane is entirely given over to traffic. And the concept of the public is of a space that is vertical, which is a view to other buildings or to pure empty space, rather than to conditions of mixture on the ground. The same kind of monofunctional public space appears more recently, for instance, in totally pedestrianized zones like that of central Frankfurt, zones in which the automobile and indeed any kind of non-consumption traffic is eliminated. It obviously appears in shopping malls. In practical activity, the public realm, this monofunctional public realm on the ground plane, became either a zone of non-interaction or of a single activity, usually the activity of consumption. The idea of a complex public realm, in which, for instance, people engaged in politics or engaged in acts of justice, intermixed with the everyday activities of work or of family life, came to seem, as in the course of 20th century planning, as something impure to be eliminated. That complexity was a sign of a lack of progress, and that purity of function was a sign of modernity. That purity of function became a way in which, one way in which public space died. A second reason why the public realm died in the 20th century was the equation of public order with the discipline of motion. Now, I put in a very abstract way what you may think about when you think about every day about traffic, or in the words of this conference, speed. The notion of having freedom of movement, of unimpeded speed, carries a subtow that we often do not recognize. In order to create speed, we have to create a kind of disciplinary condition in the city where people's movements are highly restricted, highly articulated, highly bureaucratized. To produce a highway, for instance, where the traffic moves very easily, as you have in Shanghai, in principle, you have to divide up communities from each other, separated by, as you have here, elevated highways. More, you have to organize the time of people in such a way that they observe forms of rules in their movement, which become less and less erratic and voluntary, more and more involuntary. What I'm trying to say to you at a rather theoretical level is that the pursuit of what we call freedom of movement is actually a way of unfreeing human beings to move. That is, of creating more and more discipline over their bodies. Free-flowing traffic represents a form of tyranny in public, of a disciplinary order that's required to serve that end. And that has had disastrous consequences on public life. The contrast I would give to you is one that I've written about quite a bit, is in 19th century in both Paris and London, where the notion of moving fast was not as important as the notion of being in a space, of experiencing it. That is to say, people didn't have tremendous anxiety if their movement was blocked, because when they felt free in the space, it was that whatever was there was something they could interact with. That notion of being in space is replaced by an order of passing through space, of subordinating place to motion, which in fact carries deep, deep political consequences. That is, that it becomes a disciplinary regime. And a third sign of the death of urban space in the 20th century for Western planners was the way in which the local and the public became antagonists. Rather than looking at localities as the building blocks for more impersonal spaces, for larger spaces of crowds, the notion was that the public was a discontinuous and alien realm, the realm of Gemeinschaft, the realm of small community, a realm which had to be preserved as a space of resistance against the impersonality of crowds, something we know in the ideologies of much historic preservation, though not in this very, very sophisticated and probing analysis that you gave us today of the use of historic spaces. The notion of the local as a kind of museum of intimacy and face-to-face gradually took hold of 20th century planners, so that localities became a kind of force of resistance against urbanity rather than its building blocks. Now, for me, as an urbanist, I've tried to just give of these three signs of the kind of death of the public realm. I've thought throughout the course of my life as a researcher and as a writer why this should occur, and I give you just three very brief answers as to why I think it's occurred. The first is indeed something that was raised by the very elegant talk yesterday of Dr. Duffy about office space, an analysis that applies equally to the public realm. And this has to do with the dominance in the 20th century of a Taylorite version of public space. That is, where places have defined functions, which is totally clear. One way to understand this is that although Taylorism in the capitalist system was a moment of capitalism, it lasted from the 1910s to the 1960s, Taylorism remained in urban practice throughout the century, as though we urbanists were frozen in a Taylorite kind of conception of the capitalist system. So that the notion of where things belong, where do things go, making a map of functions, which is the very essence of Taylorism, has remained in our planning practice. That is to say that a very primitive form of capitalism has remained almost unchallenged in the way in which we think about public space. If we can't define what happens, if we can't make a map of it, we are deeply uneasy. So that is a way to understand that a kind of paralysis in the early forms of capitalism, which has remained in urban planning. A second reason for this death of public space is offered us by the social theorist who never meant to write about public life at all, and that is Michel Foucault, in his analyses of what he calls surveillance. And his notion is, quite simply, that the public realm became the last test for the powers of using the eye as an instrument of repression. I'm not going to repeat the entire corpus of Foucault's work, but you know that Foucault argued it in general that in the transformation of modernity, that verbal, linguistic forms of control over people gave way in the 20th century to nonverbal visual forms of control. The famous panopticon of Foucault is an early instance of it, but his social theory is one in which non-discursive relations, in which pure visual power becomes the dominant mark of 20th century. And we, as planners, have certainly borne out this Foucauldian vision. That is, that this is it is a regime in which the search for visual order is really the search to constitute a state. And that's what we have helped enable. By making a more legible, orderly city, what we have helped to do is constitute a state, not represent it, but constitute it by making legible what the state is. Now, the third explanation for why this public realm has died out, which is associated with my own work, is not antithetical to either an explanation of this kind of paralyzed capitalism or kind of, the Foucauldian notion of a kind of visual authoritarianism, but a complement to it. In my work, what I've tried to understand is the ways in which the 20th century was unable, ironically, to cope with the notion of the mass, that is, of impersonality. And that the crisis of order in the 20th century was an inability to bring forward classic notions of the people, of urbanity in the sense of a crowd, a mixed crowd, into the modern realm. That modernity went through a crisis in my writing, embodied by both the world wars on the ground in Europe, in the notion of who was this mass of people. And the argument that I've made is that essentially the inability to deal with the notion of the crowd, of the mass, has led to an attempt to repress the very signs of mass life, of impersonal life, that threaten both economic and political order. So that in the words of Ortega y Gasset, who wrote a great and neglected book called The Revolt of the Masses, the notion of the crisis of modernity has really been one in which people cannot say, I belong here because I belong to a mass of people. Whereas in different situations, and indeed earlier in Western history, the notion of saying, I belong here because I belong to the crowd, was something that gave people rights. So my second very brief answer to you about why the public realm went into crisis really has three parts. You can look at it as a kind of paralysis of capitalism. You can look at it as a new form of power, which is pure visual rather than verbal. Or you can look at it as a crisis in the experience of impersonality and mass life. And those three all together. Now, I've given you this rather abstract brief and rather abstract picture of what went wrong with the public realm in the West as a kind of tool to answer the question, does Shanghai look backward or forward? And my initial impression to you, which I say with all due respect, is that it seems to me that you look backward to this great crisis in public life in the West in the 20th century. That what you have built in Shanghai is a monument to 20th century Western modernism. That is a regime in which is highly Taylorite. It has that element of frozen capitalism, a regime in which there is an enormous amount of disciplinary activity given over, created by the notion of enabling movement, in which the ground plane is increasingly neutralized as a space for crowds. And my impression this week has been that what I have been seeing in Shanghai is a kind of realization of the nightmare that Western urbanists have been responsible in parts for making. Now, that's a very harsh thing to say, and I don't mean it harshly. I'm looking at what's Western in what I see here. And the question I would now pose to you about this is how, rather than looking backward to our crisis of public realm, which seems embodied here in such a monumental form, how you could go forward. And I have two questions for you about this. The first is how you could create urban fabric out of the buildings that you've made. That is, these buildings are isolated objects. How do you make process out of them? How do you relate building to building? How do you do the work of creating fabric? Your discussion yesterday and your discussion this morning suggest to us that some of the elements are here culturally in a way that they weren't in the West, to make fabric out of objects. But now you have objects which are even more challenging to make relate to each other and to relate on the ground plane in particular. And my second question to you, which is related to this, is again brought up yesterday by Mr. Duffy in his presentation on offices. Among the other subtleties of his presentation to you, I thought, was that it raised the question of what does place mean? Mr. Duffy was arguing that in the modern workplace, in the modern work world, people are in many places at once. They may be sitting at one desk, but at that desk they are related to many different kinds of networks, many different kinds of activities happening at the same time. The same thing is true in the public realm. A public realm which is alive is not one place. And the people who are in public, when they feel engaged in public life, are doing many things at once. The question is how you create enough complexity and enough disorder in any particular fabric to enable people to be in many places at once. If I give you a concrete example of this, a very modern example of this, how do you create an office building which also contains, say, a school for workers or a creche for very small children, which may contain a hospital or clinic facility in it, a space which can be used for many different things, so that the sense of being there in that place is not, for the person who inhabits that space, a single identity. It seems to me you have an opportunity to make that kind of multifunction sense of place, of being a place as many things happening at the same time. Whereas the fabric that we have created in the Western cities has increasingly made it difficult for people in the public realm to experience what they would experience in an advanced office of the sort that Mr. Duffy described to us yesterday, a place where people are being many different kinds of people at the same time. If I can conclude this by returning to rather more abstract level with which I began. In my view, a living public realm is not a place which has a clear identity. It's a place in which people have to do work in order to know why they're there. It is a place in which many kinds of identities are possible at the same time, economically, in terms of class, as in terms of function. The greater clarity with which we make public places, the more deadly they become. That was our drama, the 20th century. We made deadening clarity. And you seem to me to be poised to repeat that drama, indeed to have made it a monumental space. What you now need to do is make what is too clear here less clear. And that's at least a proposition I give to you as a kind of discussion about how to have a living public realm now in Shanghai. Thank you very much.